your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. I hope you brought enough gum for the rest of the class. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is our co-host, Sammy Campbell.
Hello.
The very first time I ever podcasted, I podcasted as a guest with Sammy hosting, and she taught me everything I know about podcasting. So why don't you tell the audience out there a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am Sammy Campbell, as John mentioned. I am the former host of A Talking Cast, which was a minute-by-minute podcast about the film A Talking Cat, which John was so gracious to be a guest on. And other than that, I was an English and philosophy major at Nebraska Wesleyan University, and right now I'm kind of at a desk job, but I have academic aspirations and am a huge Austin fan.
This is a book that we've gotten a lot of requests for here at Sophomore Lit headquarters. Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, probably Jane Austen's most famous work and certainly her most adapted work. Now, I was a little bit hesitant to do this at first because I did not do this as a high school assigned reading. I did read this book as a young kid. I actually got introduced to this by way of the 1980 BBC miniseries that ran on Masterpiece Theater. I know a lot of you youngsters out there are great fans of the Colin Firth series, but for me, I will always hold Elizabeth Garvey as my first Elizabeth in my heart. I was all of 12 years old when I saw that series, and I dutifully went down and pulled the copy of Pride and Prejudice off of my parents' shelf and tried to break my way through it. I tried several times over the next many years, and I eventually did read through the entire book. So what was your introduction to Pride and Prejudice?
Well, I was about like 15 or 16 when the Keira Knightley film came out. That adaptation, the most recent film adaptation, came out. And I went to go see it because I was a big fan of Pirates of the Caribbean and therefore Keira Knightley. And it really captured my imagination. I love kind of Regency England and, you know, beautiful countryside. And it's a very beautifully shot film. It's not a favorite of a lot of Pride and Prejudice loyalists because they think it's a little bit too short and rushes through things. But I think it's a lovely adaptation, and the following year I was assigned it in my first AP literature class that I took, and from there, kind of my love affair with Jane Austen began.
Now, this is a book, as I mentioned, that a lot of people feel very strongly about. So I feel like I have to be a bit careful about what I say here with it, because I will have a lot of angry listeners on me if I say anything bad about Saint Jane, but we will try our best to be respectful, but also to be entertaining. A little bit of background about Jane Austen. Jane Austen was born in 1775, so right before the American Revolution, and she was born to a family on the lower end of the landed gentry. So in many ways, the story of Pride and Prejudice is close to her family's story. Her father had become titled gentry only after having risen up as a manufacturer of wool, I gather. And this is kind of an interesting point because a lot of Pride and Prejudice is about sort of what makes you really a member of the gentility. And she came from a large family. She had six brothers and one sister, Cassandra, with whom she was extremely close. Cassandra and Jane both were sent off to school, and they promptly became ill. They both caught typhus and had to return home. And from that point forward, their education continued at home and mostly consisted, in Jane's part, of reading every book that she could get her hands on. And she had, her father had a large library. She had a friend of the family who also had a large library, and she read an enormous amount of literature. And she was also fortunate to be coming along at just the time when there was a flowering of novels. Depending on who you believe, the novel as a form had only just been invented the last century. We can argue that point because people do argue that point, but it certainly was under 100 years old at that point when she was reading.
Just the one thing that I would like to point out, because I think it comes up a lot in her writing and kind of in her attitude towards a lot of her characters, is that she did spend some time in society in Bath. She spent, like, I think about a year there, and it was a year during which a lot of the higher society ladies were very unkind to her. One thing that is kind of a common run throughout her novels, and I don't really want to get into, well, I can, but I'm not here to argue whether Jane Austen is a feminist writer or not, but a lot of the argument against her being a feminist writer is that she is unkind to a lot of her female characters, especially the ones who are higher society. And I think the unkindness that she experienced while she was out in society was a big part of it.
As you mentioned, the family did move to Bath, and that kind of marked a point, I gather, of economic hardship. Her father died shortly after they moved there, and it turned out that the family was in some fairly dire financial straits.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, she was trying to figure out what she was going to do, and she had been trying to be an author for some time. She eventually, in 1811, was able to publish her first novel, Sense and Sensibility, which did well, but did not make her much money. Mm-hmm. And when she came out with Pride and Prejudice, her second novel, she sold the copyright away to that rather quickly because she needed the cash. And it's kind of sad to think that a book that is probably, as I said, one of the most adapted novels of all time only got for her something like £140. Austen went on to publish a few more books in her lifetime. She died rather early, sadly. I think she was 41 when she died.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of some conjecture what she died of. She had some protracted illness. And I know that some people think it was lymphoma, but it's unclear what it was. One other thing to note is that she received one known proposal of marriage in her life in 1802. And at first she thought she was going to accept it. It was from a guy who was sort of a friend of the family and someone she was not very attracted to. At first she said yes, but the very next day she said no. And people like to point to this event in her life as this moment that kind of cemented in her head that you really shouldn't marry out of convenience. And that really becomes, of course, a major theme of this book.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go into the storyline here. And I want to say before I start, this book is, I'm about 99% sure that that most of you out there who are listening to this have read this book and love it well and don't need a recap. And the other 1% of you out there, a recap isn't going to help much.
Right.
Because
twisty,
it's a very it's a very complicated story with a lot of incident. And and every time I read it, I realize that I'm mixing up in my mind from the, you know, scenes from previous readings, and I will conform to a bit of gender expectations here. I had a very hard time remembering which balls took place when, at where, So I apologize if I get any of these things wrong.
I will correct you if you get them wrong.
In any case, I'm going to try and go through this rather quickly. This story focuses on our heroine, Elizabeth Bennett, who is the second of five daughters of Mr. and Mrs. Bennett, who are a pair of lower gentlewomen in Hertfordshire. Mr. Bennett is a country gentleman with a small property, but unfortunately for the Bennett sisters, his property is under entailment, which, if you don't know your British law, means that it has to be passed on to a male heir. And since he has no male heirs, it will go at Mr. Bennett's death to a distant cousin. And so there is a certain amount of desperation in the family. It's not really characterized as desperation in the book. I think that when you mentioned the Keira Knightley movie, and I think that they make a much bigger deal out of the economic predicament that these women find themselves in.
Right.
But it's always kind of looming around the borders of the pages of this book. So there are five daughters, and really only three of them amount to much. There's Elizabeth, our hero. There is Jane, the oldest, who is her close confidant, and who is we are told is a very sweet and kind daughter. And then the youngest daughter, Lydia, becomes very important to the plot. She's a flighty and improper gentlewoman. There is also the middle daughter, Mary, who is there kind of as a butt of a lot of jokes. And there is, yes, poor Mary. And there's Kitty, who really doesn't do much except hang out with Lydia. Am I being unfair to anyone here?
No, I think it merits mentioning that that the attractiveness of each of the sisters comes up. And so in case you aren't familiar with the novel and you don't know which, Jane is by far the most beautiful by all accounts. Elizabeth is in second. And Lydia and Kitty are both kind of, they're fine, but they're just really lively and excitable, and so that makes them attractive. And Mary is kind of a wet blanket and also not cute. So that's where they all stand as far as marriageability goes in that respect.
I hesitate to bring this up now, but
yeah,
the thing that everyone who loves Austen loves is her style. And you talked about how you wanted to discuss this, and I thought you might want to bring it up right now, because from the beginning of the book, you're struck by this fascinating narrative voice, and I thought you might want to say a word about that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, before I get into it, I want to give a shout out to my favorite English professor, Scott Stanfield, who I took a whole class on Austen from, who was so excited about Jane Austen and her genius, and very enthusiastic about making sure that we understood that the free indirect speech, this narrative style, was partially, if not wholly, invented by Jane Austen. So you mentioned kind of the first passage. Everybody knows it. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. So she starts out with this narrative voice that is very worldly and knowing. And the thing that marks her style is that her narrative voice kind of has this coy, letting you in on the joke feeling. And then it has this ability to dip in and out of the perspectives of characters almost seamlessly. For example, it'll describe Mr. Darcy the way that Mrs. Bennett would see him, rather than necessarily how the narrator sees him. I have a couple passages pulled that we can get into this a little bit later.
Sure.
But her narrative voice is very strong, and it was one of the first of its kind.
So it opens, as you mentioned, with the narrator ruminating on marriage and upon the desirability of a wife to a wealthy man. And it does start at the point that Mrs. Bennet, the mother of the five daughters, is all excited because a local manor house that has been unoccupied is to be let to a respectable gentleman, Mr. Bingley, who is rumored to be worth an enormous fortune. And this represents to her, to Mrs. Bennet, the opportunity to marry off one of her daughters. Mr. Bingley is also bringing with him his friend, Mr. Darcy. We don't know about that at first, but he becomes, of course, the more important of the characters. And there is going to be a local ball that I gather is in a public house that is being thrown in honor of this new gentleman moving into the community here in Hertfordshire, which is where the story takes place. Hertfordshire, for those of you who don't know, is a bit north of London, and because of that, it's sort of a place for the kind of gentry who need to do their business in London but want to have an estate nearby that makes it convenient to travel.
Meryton is the name of the village. And yeah, this ball is all of the excitement, especially given these new people who are coming in. I think that you spoke earlier about the desperation of their financial situation being kind of on the edge of every page. And I think that the desperation has a real mouthpiece in Mrs. Bennet. She's often characterized as very silly and frivolous, but I think the more often I read this, the more I sympathize with her to an extent, because she is so concerned with the financial situation and getting her daughters married off so that she can be secure.
So at the ball, Mr. Bingley does become smitten with Jane and dances quite frequently with her. Mr. Darcy, his friend, seems to be aloof and irritated by what he sees as sort of rude country manners, although Mr. Bingley tries to encourage him to dance and to enjoy the beauty of the local women. Darcy does not, and he goes so far as to slight poor Elizabeth within earshot of Elizabeth. We're told she likes to get a good laugh out of this and that she reports it back to her sisters and to her friend Charlotte. She has a confidant, Charlotte Lucas, who's another local gentlewoman. But of course, you know, it can't help but sting a little bit to be told that you're not worthy of anyone's attention.
Right.
So this is our meet cute. The next kind of major event in the story is that Jane is going to go to Netherfield, which is the name of the estate that Mr. Bingley is renting. She goes on horseback in the rain. That's sort of, Mrs. Bennet kind of arranges it that way so that she will catch a cold and be forced to stay over. As was pointed out on the episode about Wuthering Heights, this seems to be a device that happened all the time in the 19th century. People would travel from one manor house to another. They'd get caught either by the weather or by catching cold, and they would be forced to spend a week or so at this other manor house.
Right. It's definitely an easy way to get all the characters in one place and kind of confined.
So poor Jane is forced to stay abed at Netherfield, which of course puts her in proximity of Mr. Bingley. It also puts her in proximity of Mr. Bingley's sister, who is not so fond of Jane, and who quickly realizes that the Bennet sisters may have their designs on Mr. Bingley, and moreover may have designs upon Mr. Darcy, whom she has her eyes on. Elizabeth wants to see her sister, and she is forced, because there are no horses, to walk to Netherfield. when she shows up there, that surprises Mr. Darcy quite a bit, that any gentlewoman would walk that distance. But Elizabeth perseveres. She comes in, and there's a lot of drawing room scenes now here where there's a lot of discussion of card playing. There's discussions on the importance of libraries. There's a great discussion on what it means to be an accomplished lady.
Yes, that is a very important discussion in determining the characters of Darcy and Caroline Bingley, you know, how Elizabeth relates to them. Because basically Caroline and Darcy's opinion of an accomplished woman is a woman who can play an instrument and sing and draw and speak a couple of languages and also have, you know, a certain level of dignity in her manner, and in how she speaks and how she carries herself. So even a woman who had all those talents, if she were awkward or otherwise aloof, she would not be considered an accomplished lady in their estimation.
There is a kind of a wonderful retort by Elizabeth where she says to them, "It's a wonder that you've met any accomplished ladies." And I think that when people like to look to this as some sort of a proto-feminist novel, they like to look to passages like that. I think it's kind of interesting because for me, this novel exists, you know, between worlds in a funny way, in much the same way that the Regency time period is a kind of an interstitial or liminal time between Georgian England and between Victorian England and, you know, between the end of agrarian England and the beginning of industrial England. It's hard to say where this novel comes out on sort of the women's rights and stuff.
Right.
Because on the one hand, you have someone like Elizabeth saying that the expectations of women are far too high. On the other hand, Elizabeth joins in making fun of Mary and in looking down on people whose manners are improper or...
Right. I think something that is often talked about, and one thing that I admittedly very much love and admire about Austen's novels, is that she treats kind of just the drawing room discussions of women and between women and the rehashing of social interactions, you know, between sisters, that kind of talk that is considered frivolous, you know, by other novels and by probably many people at the time, as important plot points and as things to be taken seriously. But on the other hand, she spends a lot of time making fun of and criticizing women whose main concern is frivolity. You know, for example, she discusses that Kitty and Lydia are not very intelligent, and so they go to town to shop a lot because they can't keep themselves entertained otherwise or find anything else to talk about. It's more complicated than a lot of people will make it seem when they're arguing on behalf or against Austen.
One of the main upshots of this is that Mr. Darcy, being put into close proximity with Elizabeth, starts to warm to her. He finds her very, first of all, I think he is attracted to her wit. And he also spends a lot of time talking about her physical beauty, but that doesn't mean that Elizabeth is warming to Mr. Darcy. Elizabeth sees Darcy as very proud and haughty. And this is where I think one of the things that's I find kind of funny about this book is she keeps harping on his pride, you know, and it's right there in the title, you know, you're going to have pride, pride, pride. And this kind of marks it to me as kind of a 18th century novel in a way, in the way that it wants to be an object lesson about a specific character flaw.
Right.
In some ways, you know, there's a lot of discussions about people and say, well, this is his one character flaw, which does not seem to be the way that I think modern novelists would think of characters.
But, right.
But in any case, Jane gets better. They leave. And around this point, we're introduced to another important character, Mr. Collins, who is the aforementioned cousin who stands to inherit inherit Longbourn, which is the name of the Bennet estates. And Mr. Collins comes for a visit. Collins is a very funny character. He's a minister in the Church of England, and this was something that Jane Austen's own dad was clergy in the Church of England, and this was kind of an acceptable job to have if you were a second son of gentry and didn't really have a lot of opportunities ahead of you. It was a way to achieve a certain amount of status. Of course, you would get a certain amount of income from it, but you would also have your board from it. And in the case of Mr. Collins, he had this benefactor. what's her name?
Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Right, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who will become an important character later on. And when Collins shows up at the Bennet's house, he is a mixture of obsequious with complete ostentation. In I think, just a marvelous bit of character work. He keeps bouncing back and forth between this kind of humble bragging all the time about how poor a man he is and how great it is that Catherine de Bourgh deigned to lift him up by giving him patronage to become a minister. And of course, all the while, everyone there knows that this is the guy who's going to take the manor away from the family once Mr. Bennet dies. As things stand at the moment, Collins is a lower-end gentleman than Mr. Bennet, but on the other hand, he is sort of the sort of Damocles over this family, too.
I think Mr. Collins is, like you said, he is a fantastic piece of character work. There are things that he says that still make me laugh out loud, having read this novel probably 6 or 7 times. Austen has a way of showing and not telling with a lot of characters, in that he will over-explain or over-apologize or just bore everybody to death just singing the praises of Lady Catherine de Bourgh. And everything that he says is perfectly polite and inoffensive, but the way that he says them and the way the other characters react to him illustrate how boring and just kind of awful to be around he is. And I love it when Mr. Collins is on the scene, because it's always going to be funny.
There's a great sequence where when he comes into the house, he wants to read aloud, and he's offered a novel, and he refuses to read a novel because he finds that frivolous. And instead, he pulls out a book of sermons. And one of the things that's funny about that for me is I can't help but see that as Austen's wry commentary on the whole strange place that novels were in at that time.
Right.
Because they were brand new, and they were seen as something that was frivolous. And believe it or not, the major literary form before that was books of sermons.
Mm-hmm.
We remember John Dryden today mostly, but very few people actually remember him even. There was poetry. There were, you know, if you go back to the 18th century, you had people like Pope and stuff writing long poems.
Right.
But novels were seen as kind of the scandalous, frivolous, junk literature of the time. And part of what's going on here with Austen is she's trying, I think, to push the art form ahead, because, you know, what mostly came right before her was what are called the sentimental novels or gothic novels, which were kind of a subset of sentimental novels. And both of those were just purely sensationalist.
Right, right.
I find that funny. I mean, but you know, it's a joke for nerds. So
right, it's definitely a joke for nerds. There are a lot of little jokes kind of worked in that you have to you have to be knowledgeable of the time or, you know, interested in what, you know, Austin probably thought about the subject to catch. And I think Collins is a great vehicle for a lot of her perspective on the world.
Collins is here with a with an ulterior motive. He wants to marry one of the Bennett sisters. And he, in his mind, he thinks this is going to mend the rift between his family and the Bennett family. You know, he does this as by way of apologizing.
He has a type of guilt about being the heir to Longbourn. I think he's conscious enough and conscientious enough that he realizes that this is not a great situation for the Bennets. And he hopes to fix that by marrying one of the Bennett sisters, who are also very well known to be beautiful and agreeable young ladies. So I don't think he feels too put upon by this plan.
At first he spends his attentions on Jane, but Mrs. Bennett suspects that Jane is already working to up a romance with Mr. Bingley, so she shunts him off to Elizabeth, who is horrified by him, although she also finds him very amusing. She Elizabeth, by the way, shares with her father a kind of a sardonic outlook on life. One of the great things about Mr. Bennett is the amount of time he spends laughing at people's foibles, and Elizabeth does that too. So she quite often, when she's in scenes between her and Mr. Collins, she finds herself unable to stop what Mr. Collins is saying simply because she finds it too funny.
Right.
Now there's another ball.
Yes.
And this one is at Netherfield, is it?
Yes, this one is at Netherfield.
Right.
The Mr. Bingley is very good natured and is kind of bullied by Lydia to have a ball at Netherfield, which is the home that he has rented out. I do want to mention something that we haven't mentioned yet. All of the officers are in town, and by this point, Elizabeth has met Mr. Wickham.
Let's talk a little bit about this. There are officers stationed in town, by which we mean members of the local militia. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find fascinating about this book is all the stuff that's left out, because mm-hmm. of course this is taking place, you know, famously in Regency England. So that means this is taking place at a time of governmental chaos because George III has gone nuts and has been declared unfit to rule. And his son, George IV, the regent is ruling in his stead. So there is a kind of a governmental crisis going on. At the same time, of course, this is when Napoleon is running kind of roughshod over Europe. This
right.
book comes out in, what, 1811 or is it 1812?
1812, I think. Yeah.
Right. So it's right there smack in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars. Not a word is mentioned about this. And of course, these soldiers that are stationed in town may be getting shipped out the next day to fight on the continent, you know, but their lives as soldiers aren't seen as particularly dangerous or particularly noteworthy. What they do isn't particularly noteworthy, except that we haven't mentioned that Lydia loves the sight of a man in uniform.
Yeah.
And apparently Mrs. Bennett does too.
Yeah, the only mention of the soldiers and their business in town is basically just to go to local people's houses who have young daughters and have dinner with them and go to balls and entertain the ladies.
Right.
They seem to just be kind of walking around the street and tilting their hats to pretty ladies who are out shopping for bonnets, and that seems to be the extent of what they are up to.
Now, do you know anything about this? Because this is something I was curious about. I don't know to what extent these people just being quartered in town because they need a place to keep the soldiers. Are they there as militia to kind of keep the peace because the English are still worried about They just came through one civil war last century, and whether right. I don't know what they're doing here.
Yeah, I'm under the impression that they are quartered, that they are just kind of that they might be on leave and are just in the area because they don't seem to be doing anything super organized or honestly, like every time they go out shopping, they just run into officers on the street. So it really just seems like they are that they are quartered in people's homes or in a local area where they are just kind of awaiting orders that this is where they've been asked to stay for the time being before moving on.
I think the other thing to notice about this is, as you mentioned, Mr. Wickham, one of the officers who will become very important to the story, his situation, which I won't get into too much right now, but is that this is kind of being an officer is one of the opportunities he has open to him as a member of ostensibly a member of the upper class, but without land.
Right.
What do you do? And sort of, so on the one hand, you have people like Mr. Collins who go into the clergy, and then to become an officer was kind of a dumping ground for a lot of second sons and cousins for the gentry, I think.
And I will note that I think that the young men who the women in this novel interact with who are officers, they're just that, they're officers. These are not guys on the front lines. These guys are not poor. And I think that is something to note about all of the characters in the novels, that all of these are, to a certain extent, in the landed gentry. They are, on varying levels of that, but the officers that they're dealing with are not footsmen. They're not people who would be doing the fighting, and so that may be a commentary on the state of class itself, is that, these officers are here, and can I cuss on this podcast?
Sure. Go ahead.
The officers are here, like, fucking around with ladies, they are buying, helping them pick out ribbons, and just totally goofing off, whereas, the country is a state of upheaval, but nobody in the novel seems to have any awareness of that.
Right.
And I think that's something to note.
Right. Okay. Well, so back to the ball. And this is the ball at Netherfield. At this ball, the entire Bennett family shows up, and a couple things happen. One is Mr. Darcy notes the fact that everyone seems to think that Mr. Bingley is going to propose to Jane any day now. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the elder Bennets and the younger Bennets embarrass Elizabeth by just general high spirits and kind of not observing the manners of polite society, which, to be fair, just seem to consist of the fact that Mrs. Bennett talks to people without being introduced to them.
Right.
I mean, it's not like any, she didn't get drunk and
right.
like start, bathing nude in the punch bowl or something.
Yeah,
it was
she's
just
not dancing on the table or anything. She is speaking very loudly about Jane intending to, expecting that Jane and Bingley will be engaged.
Well, anyway, I only make a note of this because this will become a point of the plot later on. The fact that the parents apparently behaved poorly, in spite of the fact that everyone does expect that any day now Mr. Bingley is going to pop the question to Jane. The very next day, Mr. Bingley leaves for London. Does he go off? I don't know where he goes off. He leaves Hertfordshire.
Right. He heads to London for business.
For business with his sister, Actually, he has two sisters, but the other sister doesn't really feature too much in the story. And Darcy with him. And so suddenly Netherfield is empty again. And Jane is perplexed and upset. She gets a letter from Mr. Bingley's sister, Caroline is her name, and says that Mr. Bingley has gone.
She expects that they will winter in London. Basically, that they have decided that Bingley was going to leave for business for a couple of days, but they decided to follow him because they expected that he would want to spend more time in the city and didn't want him to come back to the country, as they felt that would be a waste of time. And she was also mentions many times how excited, how much she would rather spend time with Georgiana Darcy, who is Mr. Darcy's younger sister, than with the people and the connections in the country.
Right. And she keeps saying things like that Mr. Bingley has absolutely no reason to stay in Hertfordshire. So she's basically dashing all of Jane's hopes. It's an odd letter, and there's a long scene of Jane and Elizabeth discussing it. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that's interesting about this novel, because people have discussions and then they discuss their discussions. And people send letters, and then they discuss the letters. Mm-hmm. And you have to be the kind of person who likes that sort of thing to like this book, because if you don't like that sort of thing, you are going to get no joy from this book whatsoever.
Right. If you just want there to be things happening, this is not the book. This is a book where people talk about things that have... something happens, and then people talk about the things that have happened for about 75% of it.
So what happens next is Mr. Collins proposes marriage to Elizabeth, surprising no one. But to his surprise, Elizabeth refuses the proposal. And there's a long, drawn-out, hilarious discussion between Mr. Collins and Mrs. Bennet, where Mrs. Bennet says that Elizabeth must be crazy, and Collins says, I'm not sure why I want to marry a crazy person. And she says, oh, I only mean she's crazy about this. Now, one of the things that Elizabeth has been doing to kind of put some distance between herself and Mr. Collins is she's been relying on her friend, Charlotte Lucas, to intercede between the two of them when they were at the ball and elsewhere, to just kind of like come in and chat him up so that poor Elizabeth can slip out of the room.
Yeah.
Before Mr. Collins is set to go back to his home, it suddenly is announced that he's decided to marry Charlotte.
Yes. They're engaged within like 3 days of him asking Elizabeth to marry him.
Elizabeth is shocked by this, and there's a kind of an uncomfortable conversation she has with Charlotte, and Charlotte admits that she is not a particularly romantic person, that this is an advantageous marriage for her, and that she's happy for that, and shouldn't Elizabeth be happy for Charlotte? And this becomes an interesting sort of open question in the book, you know, of the reasons people marry and the reasons people pair up. And Charlotte is being hard-nosed and just acknowledging all the economic reasons that a woman needs to secure a husband, and in this case, a husband who has an inheritance coming to him. It's interesting because that while we're, as readers, encouraged to take Elizabeth's point of view on these things, I don't think that Austen herself or the narrator really rebuke Charlotte for this decision.
No, I think this is this moment is more of an important moment for us as the audience to understand Elizabeth as a character and one of her flaws. And Charlotte does say something to this effect of her, is that Elizabeth has a very distinct way of seeing the world, and she has very little room for other people's perspectives being in any way correct for them. Because for Charlotte, this is a great marriage. This is as much as she could hope for. She is one in many siblings, and she is not considered attractive, and she is, you know, wasn't going to get very much money, in her inheritance as she has brothers and things like that. So, you know, any man that she can secure who is stable and has good connections, which Mr. Collins does, is an excellent marriage for her. And that's all she wants. She just wants to get settled and not have to worry about it anymore. And that's totally fair, especially for this time. Just because Elizabeth is set on only marrying somebody that she loves, has no concept of understanding why anybody would marry for any other reason, especially one of her friends.
You mentioned, by the way, by this point, Elizabeth has made the acquaintance of this officer, Mr. Wickham.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's important here is that Mr. Wickham was a childhood friend of Mr. Darcy's. Elizabeth and Mr. Wickham spend some time discussing Mr. Darcy. Mr. Wickham lets it be known that Mr. Darcy's father was a great supporter of Mr. Wickham, and that he believes that Mr. Darcy has cheated him out of what his father had meant to bestow on him.
Right.
He's been forced to make his way in the world as an officer. And so he has no particular love for Mr. Darcy. He also confirms in a lot of Elizabeth's opinion about Mr. Darcy that he's just full of pride.
Right.
Yeah.
And also just a status report on where Elizabeth and Darcy are. At the Netherfield Ball, they do dance together. They do two dances together, which means they spend about 30 minutes hanging out and talking, because they have long dances at this time. And they have a good rapport and good banter, but Lizzie is not very, not feeling very charitable towards Darcy, because she has gotten this report from Wickham about his character.
And she's also kind of developed a little bit of a crush on Wickham.
Yes.
At this point. We move forward a bit in time here. Elizabeth, in the next spring, visits her friend Charlotte at Mr. Collins' home in Kent. When they go, they are invited to the home of Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who is this grand old woman who has an inheritance. She's a woman with property, and she also has a daughter who is, what is the daughter's name?
I want to say, like, for some reason I want to say Marianne, but I don't think that's correct.
It's not important, because she exists only as this horrible creature as far as the novel is concerned.
Right.
Because she's very sickly, and she's just there as this odd projection of Lady Catherine de Bourgh's visions of how beautiful and perfect her daughter was, couched in, if she had been well, she would have learned to play the piano.
Right.
If she had been well, she would have, you know, been a great reader. If she had been well, she would have done this or that.
Right. And that really characterizes Lady Catherine de Bourgh and her kind of hypocrisy, because she sets herself up as this woman of grandeur and of taste. And she speaks to Elizabeth about how she thinks that every woman should play an instrument and every woman should sing, much like, you know, Caroline and Darcy's vision of an accomplished woman. And yet Lady Catherine de Bourgh herself doesn't play any instruments, but she is like, well, I have such wonderful taste in music that had I ever learned to play, I would have been better than anyone. And so would have my daughter if she hadn't been so sickly. So there's all of this expectation towards everybody else, but Lady Catherine de Bourgh herself is really not a very accomplished person, or a very well-read person, or somebody who has a very good understanding of the things that she claims to understand.
Darcy shows up,
yes,
too, here. For the rest of the book, by the way, this is kind of a standard thing, is that Darcy just shows up, and there's always this, like, glance of surprise between him and Elizabeth, and
yeah.
Then we get on with the kind of the smoldering romance.
Darcy's stuff. Like the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody ever expects him.
Right.
He keeps coming in and everybody's like, oh my God, it's Mr. Darcy. It's like they just kind of expect mm-hmm. him to be anywhere else.
Catherine de Bourgh expects that her daughter will marry Darcy. And this amuses Elizabeth because she hates Darcy at this point. But Darcy, of course, has become very smitten with Elizabeth. There was like a cousin here. What was his name? Colonel Fitzwilliam. Right, who speaks up on Darcy's behalf. There's a lot of people vouching for people's characters in this book. That's the other thing, is that people spend a lot of time forming their opinions based upon hearsay.
Right. And particularly with Darcy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that everyone seems to have an opinion about him and is very happy to talk to Elizabeth about their opinion.
Yeah.
Is this where Darcy makes his proposal?
You're correct. Yes. They have a few dinners. Elizabeth likes to take long walks in the country. That's kind of her favorite hobby. And he will often, quote-unquote, accidentally run into her. And on one of these accidental... Well, before this... And I hope you don't mind me taking the reins a little bit.
No, go ahead.
Before this, she is on a walk and she runs into Colonel Fitzwilliam. And he talks to her about what a great friend Darcy is. And she asks, you know, he said, in fact, he told me a really great example on the way here. And she asks him what the story was. And he was talking about how... Darcy had saved Bingley from making a proposal to a young woman who had undesirable connections, meaning Jane, and that
right. Oh yeah.
He Darcy was very proud of himself for very deftly extricating Darcy from the Bingley from the situation, because he felt that Bingley was too good-natured to have good judgment about the type of woman he ought to marry. Elizabeth is obviously furious about this. And the next day, Darcy shows up at her house. She actually avoids going to tea at Lady de Burgh's house to avoid seeing Darcy. And Darcy, on the pretense of checking on her wellness, goes to see her and makes his proposal.
Right. Now she refuses, and in a very angry way refuses, and enumerates her reasons, saying that on the one hand she's angry with him for having ruined the happiness of her sister. And on the other hand, she feels that he misused Mr. Wickham. Darcy wanders off in a daze and shows up the next morning with a letter. And this letter is one of the major turning points of the book because of the free and direct style of the narrative, which causes the narrator to kind of assume the point of view of Elizabeth. The reader will probably be on the same page with Elizabeth, seeing Darcy as kind of a villain or seeing him as certainly kind of a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And this letter, he lays out in his reasons and his motivations for everything he's done. He says specifically about Wickham that Wickham was a guy who asked for a cash payout of his inheritance, got it, and spent it all, and has been constantly getting in debt, and moreover attempted to marry Darcy's sister, or at least to elope with Darcy's sister, in an attempt to improve his station.
Mm-hmm.
Darcy's sister is apparently a shy, gentle girl who could have been taken great advantage of, at least by Darcy's standards.
Right, and she's only 15. She was only 15 at the time, so it's pretty predatory.
And on the other hand, as far as Jane goes, Darcy believed that while Bingley had a lot of affection for Jane, he did not see Jane returning that affection. He suspected that maybe this would have just been a marriage of convenience, given the fact that the Bennet parents had behaved like country bumpkins at the ball. He saw this as being again an opportunistic marriage, But he apologized for having misread Jane's personality, if he did, mm-hmm. which he was willing to avow that he must have if Elizabeth would vouch for it.
Right. And he also apologizes for... he kind of apologizes because his proposal within asking her to marry him, he's kind of a dick. And he's like, you know, I love you despite having tried to resist loving you because your family is disgusting and you have such low connections. And he goes on and on about how hard it was for him to feel any attraction to her and how much he has had to overcome to ask her for her hand. And, you know, Elizabeth obviously is not impressed with that. And so he does apologize for the delivery of his proposal as well.
So there is a scene here we have an excerpt for, which is Elizabeth's reaction to reading the letter. I think this is the turning point of the novel, and we get a bit of insight here into the way that Elizabeth's mind works on these things.
She grew absolutely ashamed of herself. Of neither Darcy nor Wickham could she think without feeling that she had been blind, partial, prejudiced, absurd. How despicably have I acted, she cried. I, who have prided myself in my discernment, I, who have valued myself and my abilities, who have often disdained the generous candor of my sister and gratified my vanity in useless or blamable distrust. How humiliating is this discovery. Yet how just a humiliation. Had I been in love, I could not have been more wretchedly blind. But vanity, not love, has been my folly. Pleased with the preference of one and offended by the neglect of the other, on the very beginning of our acquaintance, I have courted prepossession and ignorance, and driven reason away where either were concerned. Till this moment, I never knew myself.
I think, like you said, this is a turning point in the novel. This is a turning point in Elizabeth's character. You know, she reflects, until this moment, I had not known myself. And I think Elizabeth is a widely celebrated heroine in literature, and for good reason. And she's often celebrated for her independence. But as you said before, she is very sardonic, and I think what comes along with being somebody who is detached and playful and likes to enjoys making fun of others and delights in ridiculousness, you know, that's something I can relate to myself. But the other side of that is that you end up being pretty judgmental a lot of the time, because it makes the joke easier if you paint people with broad strokes, and that can bleed over into your personal opinions. And I think in this moment, you know, she discovers how uncharitable she can be.
Elizabeth departs from Kent and things are kind of left hanging. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel like she can go back, and her emotions are changing towards Mr. Darcy, but she feels like she can't really say, you know, about that proposal, you
right.
know. And so things are kind of left up in the air. But at about this time, is this where Wickham runs off with Lydia?
Not quite yet.
No, not quite yet.
She goes home, and Jane returns home from London, where Jane had spent like 3 months in London with her aunt and uncle, Mr. and Mrs. Gardner. And they basically, the Cliff Notes version of that is she hung out with Caroline Bingley. Caroline Bingley was not very nice to her, and Jane doesn't think that the Bingleys like her very much anymore. And but she was under the impression that they were great friends. Lydia decides to go to Brighton to spend time with her friend who is married to some officers. It's where all the officers who were in Meryton went to Brighton. They moved on. And so she goes to follow them for the time. And Elizabeth decides to travel to the countryside, a tour of the countryside with Mr. and Mrs. Gardner. And this is where she sees Pemberley.
This is another thing that I just don't understand enough about the manners of the gentry to understand what's going on here, because they're kind of wandering around further north. Pemberley is Darcy's estate, and it's pretty much pretty far north at this mm-hmm. point. And they're just kind of traveling, and her uncle and aunt say, "Oh, you want to go see Pemberley?" Mm-hmm. And they say, "Oh, sure." And Darcy is supposedly gone, and they're just going to kind of like check in.
I can fill you in a little bit on this, but go ahead.
I mean, it feels sort of like all the gentry of England are just kind of like wandering around with open door policies of like, oh yeah, okay, just show up, you know, make sure you put the key back into the flower pot. No, what were you gonna say?
It's pretty. It's a very weird, very British thing, and very, you know, very of its time. But I guess the grand houses, such as Pemberley would be, don't only represent just the Darcy family, but it means that he is a landlord to an entire village. And this house kind of represents the community in a way, and his land does. And so often, you know, tourism at the time, the sights to see would be these grand houses. And you could come in and I guess kind of the way that you would tour the White House a little bit, sure. As a, like a representation of the country. It's a representation of the community and of the person who owns it. And so the housekeeper would give you a tour, often with the family in the house, but as long as the family isn't, you know, having a terrible time or something, that it was pretty much part of sightseeing for the landed gentry. It was part of entertainment to just go stroll along the grounds and take a look at what statues people had and what kind of furniture they had, because there wasn't really anything else to look at, I guess.
So, of course, they go visit Pemberley, and Elizabeth only consents to go when she has it reported that Darcy isn't there. Which, of course, means that Darcy's going to show up.
Right.
And he does. And there's another one of these kind of, like, glancing back and forth between the two of them. And,
right. But my favorite, I laughed a little bit at the housekeeper of Pemberley at how glowing a report she gave of Mr. Darcy. It's right. Just like, he's the best master, and he's the best landlord, and he's the best human being I have ever right. met. And she just goes on and on and on, and it's like 3 pages.
There's a sequence where they're looking at a portrait of Darcy and talking about this. I remember I saw that scene adapted in the 95 Colin Firth version of this, and it just does not work as a as a bit of drama to no. have people standing looking at a portrait and talking about it. It's just a terrible terrible yeah. piece of scenery. But anyway, so Darcy does show up, and now somewhere around here I think it is that news comes back that yes. Lydia has eloped with Mr. Wickham.
Yep. So basically, Elizabeth and Darcy meet up, and Darcy is very polite, and he keeps inviting them back, and Elizabeth's a little surprised by this, because the aunt and uncle are of a lower class, and they're spending a lot of time together, and really getting their flirt on. Things are going really well. Then all of a sudden, she gets this emergency letter from Jane.
Right. And the and people don't know really what's gone on, because not only has Lydia disappeared, but Mr. Wickham is kind of AWOL as far as his superior officer is concerned. No one really knows. They think he's gone up to, what, to Scotland or something like that? Where do they end up? And they basically are gone. And it's a funny thing how the book is kind of trying really hard to avoid saying, They're just, you know, they're up somewhere, you know, just humping like bunnies.
That's right. Right.
And so they keep saying, like, do you think they could have gotten married, which would make it all right?
They keep saying elopement, which I think means something a little different at the time than it does now. They've run off together and they're unsupervised. And Lydia has left this, you know, very careless note that's like, oh, Wickham and I have left and we're going to have a great time. And I hope to be Mrs. Wickham, but I'm not really worried about it. So, yeah, there's this idea that they have disappeared, that they have left to Scotland and are spending all their time together as a couple without intention of getting married.
Elizabeth has gone home to be with the family at this point, and then suddenly they get word that Lydia and Wickham have been found and that they are, in fact, going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Mrs. Bennet is just delighted. She doesn't – all of her concerns about the morality of what's going on kind of fly out the window because they're getting married. Mr. Bennet and Elizabeth think that it was Uncle Gardner who must have bribed Wickham to marry Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Bennet is all upset because he's worried that this puts him into debt to Uncle Gardner.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new Mr. and Mrs. Wickham show up back at Longbourn, where Lydia is all happy and excited and not at all ashamed of anything that she's done.
Right.
And she mentions that Mr. Darcy was an attendee at their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And so Elizabeth keeps thinking, boy, what could this mean? What could this mean? She sends a note to her aunt, who writes her back to explain that it was, in fact, Mr. Darcy who basically funded this marriage, you mm-hmm. know, because Mr. Wickham had no intention of marrying. He saw no financial advantage to this, but apparently Darcy agreed to pay off his debts.
Yeah, which is like upwards of £10,000 or something like that. It's like, it's an incredible sum for the time.
So now they're married, and there's an interesting scene between Elizabeth and Wickham where, you know, Wickham is kind of like, aren't I a naughty boy to Elizabeth?
Yeah.
You know, like he's like, well, I guess I had you fooled about me. But Elizabeth takes the point of view of, I'm going to do my best to treat you like my brother-in-law now. And it's kind of shows where Elizabeth has gotten to.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an interesting sequence because Mr. Bennet talks with Elizabeth about how fun it will be to have such a rake for a son-in-law. And Elizabeth actually spends a little bit of time in introspection about how, around this time, about how Mr. Bennet has been kind of not a great father.
Right.
First of all, he kind of let this all, he let Lydia kind of run wild and go off and didn't do anything to stop this. And she also recognizes in her father all this kind of sarcastic view of the world that she herself sees as being kind of not so great about herself.
Right. It's like, you know, he's not concerned. He realizes that Wickham is going to be a terrible husband to Lydia and that she's probably going to be very unhappy. But instead of worrying about his daughter's well-being, he's looking forward to the prospect of being entertained by their stupidity, which I think is just speaks volumes about the kind of person that Mr. Bennet is. As delightful as I find him, he's not maybe the nicest human being on the planet.
Right.
Or most considerate.
Right. Now, on top of all this, around this time, Lady Catherine de Bourgh shows up again.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure I get the sequence of events right here. Now, did she show up before or after Bingley shows up and proposes?
After. She shows up pretty directly after the proposal between Jane and Bingley is settled.
Right. So now the next thing that happens is Bingley shows up, back from outer space, like the song goes, and and suddenly it proposes marriage to Jane. So Mrs. Bennet is in heaven. Now mm-hmm. she's got two daughters married off, and especially right. Mr. Bingley is, you know, quite a catch.
Right.
And Elizabeth is kind of just full of wonder at all this. You know, she does at the fact that Bingley is back, and does she suspect that Darcy did this at this point, or does she have to be told that later? I don't remember.
I think she suspects that Darcy's involved, because Darcy does make a short appearance. When Bingley first shows up, Darcy is with him, and then he leaves for a couple of days, and while Darcy is gone, Bingley proposes. So
right.
I think she suspects that before Darcy left, he was like, oh, P.S., I was wrong about Jane before. You should totally go for it.
Right. So Catherine de Bourgh shows up, and there's another hilarious long sequence where she basically berates Elizabeth because she thinks that Elizabeth is going to get to marry Darcy, mm-hmm. and like the rumors are that Darcy's going to propose to him, and this is terrible because she's stealing him away from her daughter, mm-hmm. who is engaged to him, and Elizabeth says, is she really engaged to him? Because you have to understand they were meant for each other, is what I mean.
Yeah.
And
it's like, we talked about this when they were babies.
And there's a lot of discussion here about what makes someone an actual gentleman.
Right.
Again, this is one of these things about the book where it's sort of like forward-looking but also backward-looking, because in the end, Elizabeth asserts that just by virtue of his title, her father is as much a gentleman as anyone,
right?
Even though he's definitely sort of on the bottom tier of the gentry. And so there's kind of an odd halfway sticking it to the to the class system. It's sort of like,
right,
well, there still are classes, but we made it, you know, we're in it, you know, so.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, it's like, as long as you have a title, you're all the same. So it's equality among the landed gentry.
Right.
Revolutionary. Right.
Catherine de Bourgh makes the mistake of asking Elizabeth to swear that she wouldn't accept a proposal from Mr. Darcy. And Elizabeth basically says, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, I'm not going to swear that. That's not going to happen. But, and then lo and behold, the very next day, Darcy shows up and reproposes.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the reason he reproposed was Catherine de Bourgh, upon not getting satisfaction from Elizabeth, ran back to Darcy and reported everything that happened and says, now you swear. And of course, all Darcy hears is that Elizabeth won't forswear marrying him.
Right.
And as he points out to Elizabeth, she's so headstrong that he knows she would have been happy to swear not to marry him if she weren't actually secretly in love with him.
Right, right, exactly. That she, if she didn't at least have some good opinion of him, she would have very happily talked shit about him to his aunt. So she would not have held back.
So the book ends with a little epilogue chapter. One of the things that's kind of funny about this epilogue chapter is that it does actually say, you know, things weren't so great between Lydia and Wickham, you know, mm-hmm. and it was kind of like, but it isn't like they drove each other to drink and whatever. It's more like they had a kind of a crappy marriage.
Right.
But everyone else was happy.
Right. Yeah. And Wickham and Lydia keep begging everybody else for money, and they don't really like each other. And Jane and Bingley got a house near Pemberley, so they hang out all the time. And you know, Elizabeth and Darcy are so happy and so in love, and you know, Darcy's little sister lives with them, and they love each other, and everybody just is having a great time except for Wickham and Lydia, pretty much. And Mary. Mary is the old maid, pretty much.
Yeah, poor Mary. No one. I felt really bad for Mary this time reading the book. I mean, it's not just everyone in the story is making fun of her. It's the narrator is making fun of her. Elizabeth is making fun of her.
Yeah.
I just don't like it.
Yeah. Everybody is mean to Mary.
You know, we've touched a little bit upon, I think, some of the reasons why people love this book are definitely the style. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we had to kind of run through a ton of plot here, but the what makes the book kind of engaging is this very light, ironic touch that's brought to things that could be a little overwrought or ponderous. The other thing that people like to point to is this book does mark a kind of a transition between a kind of an earlier sentimental form of novel in which people had kind of overblown emotions and it was always about virtue being rewarded and inequity being punished. And this is kind of a more, you know, while there's something of a fairy tale aspect to the story of the right couples coming together in the end, there's a lot of realism to this too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we end with the same kind of situation insofar as Mr. Collins is a jerk and he's still going to inherit the family estate.
Right.
You know, Mary is still left out in the cold, you know, and there is kind of a way in which, you know, someone like Lady Catherine de Bourgh, while she doesn't get a marriage for her daughter, you know, she's still on the top of the heap as far as things go. Whereas if you went back to the 18th century model, I think that there would be an attempt to kind of punish
right.
the villains of the piece.
Right.
And there is no such attempt here.
Yeah, I agree. I think that something that really sets this novel and Austen in general apart is that, you know, people who do have overwrought emotional reactions are definitely treated as silly or frivolous characters. Whereas the characters who are a little bit more grounded, who are a little bit more realistic, are celebrated. Even in Jane and Bingley, who are definitely good guys, it is commented upon that they're both so good natured and so sweet and so unwilling to think ill of anyone that they are often taken advantage of by Lydia and Wickham. Mr. Bennet says that, you know, they'll never be able to fire a servant and that, you know, they're just going to spend all of their money because they're both so kind. Whereas Darcy and Elizabeth, it's remarked upon that theirs is the happiest marriage because they are realistic about each other's flaws and they're realistic about other people.
And the other thing that happens in that sequence when right after the proposal and the acceptance is there's a long discussion about sort of, let's have a kind of a postmortem about everything that went wrong in this relationship.
Right.
And they talk at length about the ways in which each of them is calling the other out on their own bullshit. Darcy admits, yeah, I was full of myself mm-hmm. until you came along and told me I was being ungentlemanly.
Right.
And Elizabeth is, I was so quick to judge people and to believe my point of view was the only point of view. And that kept me from realizing what a great guy you were. Mm-hmm. It's romance as a form of self-improvement. This is in many ways a meeting of equals. It's certainly of equal wits.
Right.
They're very funny together, but they also complement each other's problems.
Yeah, and I think I remember when I first read this, I was 17, and now looking back on this idea, it's a little reductionist, but I remember reading this and going like, oh, this is the first romantic comedy. You know, as in kind of the formula that we know it today, they hate each other at first, or, you know, one hates the other one because they have the wrong idea, and through trial and tribulation, they get together, and, you know, the best scenes are where, in my opinion, are where Elizabeth and Darcy are bantering, and, you know, there aren't that many of them, but they're definitely, like, the most enjoyable scenes for me. I love Elizabeth and Darcy together talking because they, even when Elizabeth hates Darcy, she's willing to have this playful banter with him that he doesn't really allow anybody else to do. He doesn't really like to be made fun of or, you know, taken lightly. And so I love their dynamic. And I remember feeling that way when I was a teenager reading this.
Let's talk just briefly here about adaptations, because I think a lot of people did come to this first through adaptations. And you mentioned the Keira Knightley movie. Now, the one thing that I think that movie is well recognized for is the way that it does heighten the sense of sort of the economic realities of what's going on here. And it's interesting that for the adaptation that's the shortest adaptation out there, it's the one that really pushes this hyper-realist approach.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Colin Firth one, I think it's telling that people refer to that mostly by Colin Firth's performance.
Right.
Because I think that if people remember much of that, they remember Firth. He kind of plays Darcy not so much as a proud person, but as someone who's got like a lot of social anxiety and is kind of like awkward around people, you know. It's kind of like more that, rather than the fact that he's too proud to talk to people, it's just he doesn't know how to talk to people.
Right. And I definitely think that that's an element of Darcy's character. I think in addition to being a very proud person, I think he is also a pretty awkward person. There are a lot of times where he and Elizabeth are just sitting in silence, and Elizabeth's like, well, I'm not going to say anything. He came here, he can start the conversation, and he doesn't. Or, you know, their conversation starts to get too comfortable, and he picks up a newspaper. Darcy has a lot of awkward qualities, which make him really endearing, but I do think that people are drawn to the Colin Firth performance, because Colin Firth is Colin Firth and has the best smolder in the business, and that he is able to command this kind of impressiveness while really just being like a fumbling goofball at his heart, which people like about Mr. Darcy.
We should probably close this up here because this has run really long.
Yeah. I know that that this is a really beloved book, and I am definitely somebody who loves it very much and who gets something new out of it every time. And I think that an important thing, and I would encourage your listeners on their next reread, is to disengage from the romance a little bit and think more about all of the other things that are going on in this novel that make it so remarkable. Because I do think that the romance is what has popularized it, but I don't think that Jane Austen is just a romance novelist. I think that, and not to diminish romance in any way, but I think that she is writing a lot about a lot of really ground level things about life in this time and for ladies of this time and of this class. And I think she has a lot of amazing things to say if you are willing to look past getting swept up with Mr. Darcy. So that's kind of my closing thought. And that comes from somebody who has an I Heart Mr. Darcy t-shirt. So
thanks to co-host Sammy Campbell. You can subscribe to Sammy's newsletter, Highly Illogical, at tinyletter.com/SpockGirl, spelled G-R-R-L. Thanks to Caroline Fulford for reading the excerpt. Her The Loose Cannon podcast is about movies, and it's available on iTunes. The theme music is still by Malcolm Nygaard, and he's got a podcast too, Apoc Radio, available on iTunes. If you're musical and want to submit new outro music, let me know. You can email me about that or anything else at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, where we have a book club, and we're all book nerds. Remember, everything will be on the final.